It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Coming up later this hour, find out how climate change might lead to more conflict among us in years ahead.
Plus, a look at new state legislation that would prohibit employers from asking employees and job applicants to hand over their social media passwords.
But first, we'll celebrate one staple of American cuisine, soul food. Our next guest is the author of a new book that explores the line where Southern food ends and soul food begins, and why soul food became so closely associated with African-American cooking.
Adrian Miller is a writer, attorney, and certified barbecue judge. He's the author of Soul Food, the surprising story of an American cuisine one plate at a time. Adrian, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, tell me about this book, Soul Food. You call it a biography of soul food. What is it you wanted people to know?
Well, first, I want people to understand the complexity of the cuisine and appreciate it more. I think it's pretty unsung, even though it's been around for a while. And sometimes I think people think soul food is something weird that African-Americans eat. But by telling the story, I think the true Americanness of it, the universality of it, comes to light.
So trace the history for us of soul food. Tell us about it.
Okay, so obviously part of the story begins in West Africa, where most African-Americans trace our heritage. And the tradition of eating leafy greens, a lot of vegetables, maybe meat used as seasoning and other things, crosses the Atlantic during the slave trade and takes root mainly in the South. And so during slavery, most enslaved African-Americans had controlled rations. So once a week, they got maybe 2 pounds of smoked or salted meat, which could be beef, pork, or fish, depending on where they were, 5 pounds of cornmeal, and some molasses. And then other than that, they had to raise their own food after they finished working. So a lot of enslaved African-Americans had gardens. They fished and hunted. And so that's where we see a lot of the southern staples come into the soul food diet. So black-eyed peas, mixed greens, sweet potatoes, all of those things start to show up there. And then soul food distinguished itself from southern food once African-Americans left the South en masse in the early 1900s through the 1970s, what was called the Great Migration. And when they showed up in other places around the country, they tried to recreate home, just as other immigrants do, but they couldn't always grow the same southern foods that they could in the South. So they tried to make substitutes and other things just to kind of recreate that meal. So even though there's a lot of overlap between southern and soul, I think soul food is a limited version of southern food, but it gets its own intensity. It's got more intense seasoning and other things, which show kind of an African-American culinary signature.
Now, one of the things that you've said is that initially soul food was more a matter of place than of race, and that doesn't seem to be the case today. How do you describe what's happened?
Well, I think the reason why it's more about race now is because in the 60s, there was a conscious effort during the Black Power Movement days to make soul food seem like something exceptional, because before that, white Southerners and black Southerners were pretty much eating the same foods if they were part of the same social caste. So during the 60s, there was this conscious effort to say, look, white people cannot understand soul food and can't make it and really can't relate to it. And I think that psychological migration, it signifies the departure. And so soul food kind of gets divorced from southern food and becomes its own thing, even though there's a lot of overlap.
So why do you think that it's one of the more unappreciated cuisines out there?
Well, there's been a steady drumbeat of criticism against soul food, and for two reasons. One is the health consequences. Looking at the health challenges in the African-American community, I think a lot of people just made some shorthand thinking, believing that soul food was the main cause for that. And in my book, I asked for some more critical thinking about that, because I think there's just a lot of processed food in the diet of African-American these days, and I think that has a role in the story about obesity and chronic disease. And then the second part is this idea that soul food was the master's leftovers. And so critics of soul food said, look, by eating those foods, you're internalizing white superiority and black inferiority. So I think those two things have made it a rather unpopular cuisine in many circles.
Now, it sounds like you've poured over hundreds of cookbooks as you trace this journey. Who are the stars of the soul food tradition?
So a lot of them were unnamed, a lot of unnamed cooks that were cooking in the big houses and also for the field hands. But in terms of the cookbooks, the one star that I wanted to talk about was Melinda Russell. And she is probably the earliest African-American cookbook writer that we've discovered so far. And she wrote a cookbook in 1866, but she wasn't in the South. She was in Paw Paw, Michigan. when she wrote that book. But she was from Virginia, and you see a lot of signature cooking there. And you've got what Abby Fisher knew about Southern cooking. It shows the early roots of soul food. But then you fast forward to the 60s and so. So Sylvia's cookbook, the Sylvia's the signature restaurant out of Harlem, has a lot in the story. And Edna Lewis has a role, even though she went to great lengths not to say her food was not soul food, but her care and you know what she did for Southern cooking had a strong influence on how African Americans cooked around the country. So those are the real stars to me.
So, Adrian, did you try out a lot of these recipes while you were researching your book?
Yeah, yes, absolutely, because I knew I had to have some street cred when it came to the recipes. So,
it's a dirty job, but somebody had to do it.
Right. Some were from my parents, and some were from family friends, and others were from cookbooks that I came across, and I thought, well, you know, these are good things. And then others were from the restaurants that I ate in. During my year of research, my year of eating dangerously, I called it, in 2011, I went to 35 cities, 15 states, including Milwaukee and Madison, and I ate in 150 restaurants. And so if the restaurant owner was in a sharing mood, I tried to get the recipe out of him. But I got to tell you, that's one of the hardest things, is to get a recipe out of a cook.
What blew you away?
In terms of what I found on the soul food trail?
Yeah.
The most surprising thing was the extent that soul food restaurants are not cooking with pork when it comes to their side dishes. Most have switched to smoked turkey, and in fact, a large number are completely vegan on
really?
Their side. And they actually are proud to tell you that.
Hmm.
I mean, it got to the point, I was in the Deep South, and I said to myself, can a brother get some pork?
Well, let's talk a little bit about the foods that make up the soul food cuisine. What do people tend to associate with soul food?
Yeah, so the way I wrote my book is I created a representative soul food meal, and I write a chapter about every part of that meal. So for me, the entrees tend to be fried or smothered chicken, and then fried catfish, and then chitlins. And for those who don't know what chitlins are, they're stewed pig intestines that could also be fried. And then in terms of the sides, you've got black-eyed peas, greens, and the soul food greens tend to be collards, mustard, turnip, and kale, and maybe cabbage. Then you've got sweet potatoes, macaroni and cheese, and then cornbread as the bread of the dish. And then always dash it with some hot sauce. And the dessert can be sweet potato pie, peach cobbler, banana pudding, or pound cake. And then you all wash this down with a red drink. Because personally, I feel red Kool-Aid is the official soul food drink.
Red Kool-Aid. Is it always Kool-Aid, or is there sometimes a secret recipe?
Oh, sometimes a secret recipe. You can throw other things in there. But as long as it's red, that's the important thing. So it can be Kool-Aid, tropical punch, strawberry soda. There's all kinds of things it can be, but it has to be red. And red is a flavor in soul food circles.
Red is a flavor. You know, we've got a recipe up on the Central Time Facebook page. It's Janetta's Mixed Greens. Can you tell us something about that one?
Yeah, so that's one of my favorite things to make. So you hear a lot about collard greens. And that seems to be the most popular soul food green. And one of the reasons for that is that collard greens were easier to ship. They held up along the train routes and boat routes. And so collards were kind of the first things to show up in these outposts where African Americans settled after leaving the South. But my mom grew up in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and she was used to making mustard and turnip greens. And so that's kind of what I got used to making. And the variation in that recipe is that I use smoked turkey instead of ham hocks. Just to give it a little healthier feel.
All right. Well, you can check it out on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with Adrian Miller about his new book, Soul Food, The Surprising Story of an American Cuisine, One Plate at a Time.
And we want to hear from you. Do you eat soul food, and do you feel comfortable cooking it? Maybe you want some tips and some advice on what foods to toss into your dish. You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks, Kristen. I'm Cynthia Schuster with Veronica Rickert, and this is Central Time.
We're continuing our conversation with Adrian Miller about the history and cultural significance of soul food.
We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234, or leave your questions and comments on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we want to go to the phones right now. We have Pedro joining us from Fond du Lac. Hi, Pedro.
Hello. Let me say, I love soul food. I haven't had that many opportunities to eat it, but I had a lady from Louisiana invite my wife and I over to dinner once, and it was just amazing. I couldn't believe how much food they had.
What did she serve, Pedro?
For like 15 people in Minneapolis. And I remember those 10 people, and I swear to you, they could have fed 50. I mean, there was like 7 sweet potato pies, and then there was pecan pies and greens. Oh, my God, it was mind-blowing. It was awesome food. But anyway, a question. Wondering, has there been any attempt to make a fancy restaurant with soul food, kind of like what Rick Bayless has done with what has previously been considered a low cuisine and Mexican food, and Rick Bayless has, you know, really kind of put Mexican food in a silk dress. Is there anybody trying to do that with soul food at all, or it's such great food? And but just
yeah,
wondering.
That's a great question, Pedro. What do you think about that, Adrian? Have you heard anything?
Yes, absolutely. So, Pedro, thanks for the call. And there are two kind of trends going on. So one is soul food is getting upscale. And the interesting thing is that once it goes upscale, the proprietors of these restaurants are calling it Southern. And so in Atlanta and San Francisco, I definitely remember, and even in Houston and Dallas, I remember some upscale kind of soul food restaurants. So the one that's most memorable to me is 1300 Fillmore in San Francisco. That place was pretty amazing. And again, doing the same thing that Rick Bayless is doing with Mexican food, trying to weave in some upscale ingredients but also stay true to the traditions.
But what do you think about how they're calling it Southern?
I think it makes sense because, from a marketing perspective, because of the negative association with soul food. I completely get why they're doing that, and I'm hoping my book and other things will kind of change that so people will go back and embrace that term.
Yeah, maybe you should send them a letter and say, hey, guys, you should be calling this soul food.
Hey, that's a great idea.
And here's my book.
Yeah. Oh, there you go. I might have to hire you as a publicist.
Well, people seem to think, I mean, why do you think this has persisted, this idea that it's unhealthy? I mean, you even write about watching TV shows where African-American families are making jokes about soul food instead of celebrating it.
Yeah, so I think part of it is soul food is just relatively unknown because it hasn't been, depictions of it, at least positive ones, haven't been in the mainstream. I mean, if you think about it, in terms of what's on food television these days, I mean, there's no one really identified with soul food, so there's just not a lot of positive representations. And I think the second thing is that the its slave food critique has been very, very strong. And so often African-Americans who critique it are often coming from a Muslim perspective, or other things, or a black nationalist perspective, and that's just really had staying power.
So, you know, over time, our views of certain foods and the nutritional makeup of certain cuisines kind of changes our relationship with food. And I'm wondering, how has soul food evolved to cater to the concerns that it might be unhealthy?
So what you're seeing is a substitution mainly of pork. I mean, people are taking pork out and either using smoked turkey or spices to compensate for that lack of that pork flavoring. And they're still trying to keep up with the flavor profile, although I have to say, after eating around the country, I find a lot of people are not seasoning as well as they should, so there's just a sea of bland vegetables out there. The other thing is trying not to fry as much, doing more baking and grilling, and then trying to up the amount of fish and chicken and other things, and really the vegetable part of it. So I think it's the less frying and less pork have been the two biggest changes.
Now, you talked about a sea of bland vegetables out there. What kind of seasoning is the hallmark of soul food? Are there particular spices that you taste them and you go, oh, yeah, that's soul food?
Yeah, so when you look at cookbooks and other things, you tend to see red pepper for sure, and then garlic, and then onion are pretty much the holy trinity, as I see it, with soul food seasoning. And then depending on the dish, you'll see thyme and some other things, but it's really kind of garlic, onion, and that red pepper that seems to show up the most.
And then meanwhile, we've been talking about things like cornbread, sweet potato pie, and other sweet flavors that we're mixing in with the savory. What's the significance of that?
So cornbread is the perfect example, because what I found in my research that was a surprise is that there was this line between southern cornbread and northern cornbread, where northern cornbread was considered to have sugar in it and southern cornbread didn't. And there were a lot of reasons for that, mainly because of the sweetness of the cornmeal that southerners were using. And so southerners say if you have sugar in your cornbread, it's cake. Well, here's the interesting thing. Black southerners have always had sugar in their cornbread to some extent. And so that line between savory and sweet is doesn't seem geographical as much as white Southerners would kind of lay it out there. So I thought that was just a very interesting thing. And in other dishes, you do see sweet things showing up, like in black-eyed peas recipes with a touch of molasses, some greens with molasses in there, or a pinch of sugar to cut the bitterness.
It is really hard talking about this right before dinner time. I have to tell you, I don't know if you're hungry too. I want to talk a little bit about mac and cheese. That's another one that, you know, it's everybody eats macaroni and cheese these days, but it is sort of particularly the domain of soul food too. What makes for really essential soul food macaroni and cheese?
So there are really two ways to do it. So one is the eggy, kind of goopy casserole that you'll get on a Sunday for Sunday dinner. And the other one is a macaroni with cheese sauce. And the whole point is to have a really meltable cheese. But I think a lot of people like the casserole method a little bit more, something more a little substantial. But creaminess with the cheese and kind of that a goopy is, I know, not appetizing, but that's the best way for me to describe it.
Well, we still have a few minutes if you want to get a call in and a question in for Adrian Miller. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Adrian, can you talk a little bit about the plight of the soul food restaurant these days? Why have they been suffering lately?
Well, I think, again, because of the reputation of soul food cuisine and also because of where soul food restaurants are, they just don't get the patronage that other restaurants get. If you think about it, you don't see many soul food restaurants survive outside a black neighborhood. So with integration and other things and the ability of African Americans to live in other parts of the city, these neighborhood joints suddenly became destination places, and people are just not visiting them regularly enough to support them. And then also, the restaurant proprietors, once they get to a point where they want to hand the business over to someone, there's really no one there to hand it to. The kids often are uninterested, and there's really no one groomed to keep the restaurant going. And running a restaurant is difficult anyway. It's hard work, but you just don't see that generational transfer that you see with other ethnic cuisines. So I think a lot of those things are coming together to really hurt soul food restaurants. And then soul food restaurants need to raise their game in terms of being a business. I mean, you got to have a website. You got to get on Yelp. You got to have the things on your menu that you say you have. You know, all those things will help increase their longevity.
Now, for a cuisine really to come into its own and be popularized and, you know, kind of get the Rick Bayless treatment like Pedro was talking about before, people have to also kind of get interested in cooking it and being able to have people cooking it outside of the group of people it's associated with, kind of like Julia Child popularized French cuisine. What do we need to know to start cooking soul food? And are people cooking it more now outside of, you know, Southerners or African Americans?
Yeah, so that's the weirdest thing. I think a lot of people are interested in watching food on television, but not necessarily cooking it. And so I hope that in my book, I talk about how a lot of our elders haven't passed that on to the kids, and a lot of times it's because the kids weren't so interested. But I think with the rise of chef celebrity culture, you're starting to see more young people interested in cooking, and I'm hoping that soul food will be one of the traditions that they try to reinvigorate and cook more often. So I think the tide is turning because for a long time, at least with African Americans, because cooking was one of the few professions we could pursue, there was a stigma about it once we had other options. And I think that's changing. That was in professional kitchens as well as at home. But now that people are starting to see the connectedness and the popularity of food culture, I'm hopeful that that will change.
So, you know, we've had this conversation for the last half hour talking about how people might not appreciate soul food for what it is. What's one thing you want people to walk away from this conversation knowing and appreciating about soul food?
So if you look at soul food, even though it has an unhealthy image, the things that dietitians and others are telling us to eat, dark leafy greens, beans, sweet potatoes, those things are the building blocks of soul food. So it's more about how the food is prepared than what the food actually is. So, and then, as I said earlier, a lot of soul food restaurants have become healthier in what they're offering for their customers. So give the cuisine and these restaurants another look and help support them so that soul food doesn't go by the wayside.
And real quick, Adrian, we've got a listener who wants to know if you have a cheese recommendation.
A cheese recommendation?
For soul food. Probably mac and cheese, I think she's thinking.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm pretty old school. I go with the cheddar.
Cheddar.
The mild cheddar. But I like Tillamook cheddar the most.
All right. Well, cheddar's an okay answer here in Wisconsin. Well, Adrian, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
That was Adrian Miller, author of Soul Food, The Surprising Story of an American Cuisine, One Plate at a Time. And don't forget, we've got that recipe up on the Central Time Facebook page. It's for Janetta's Mixed Greens.
Coming up, find out how climate change might affect human conflict in the years to come. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Kristen Durst. The process of signing up people for insurance under the federal health overhaul law is being discussed at meetings across the state. More than 60 people from 8 southern Wisconsin counties gathered today for the first of 10 meetings planned over the next 2 weeks. State Medicaid Director Brett Davis says he expects more than 1,000 people to attend the meetings to get more information and learn how they can participate in signing people up for health insurance under the new marketplace.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, Al Jazeera America launches today. The new network is trying to reverse trends in American cable news with more investigative reporting and less opinion.
But first, does hot weather make you cranky and irritated?
Well, it turns out that the relationship between heat and agitation could have a pretty big impact on society as a whole.
A new study in the journal Science shows that historically, shifts in climate have led to an increase in violent conflict around the world.
And using data from the past, researchers have tried to assess how climate change today might affect levels of violence in the future.
They found that by 2050, violence between groups of people could increase by 50%.
Joining us now is Professor Edward Miguel. He's a researcher involved in the study and the Axfam Professor in Environmental and Resource Economics at UC Berkeley. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what accounts for the connection between heat and violence?
Well, in our study, we looked at a variety of forms of violence, and we found something very striking. When you look across societies, if you look at everything from crime in U.S. cities all the way up to civil wars in Africa or riots in India, when it gets very hot, and you have other forms of extreme climate like drought, you have more violence. It's a very striking statistical relationship.
Why? What is it about heat, though, that causes this to happen?
There are a couple different explanations that the researchers in this field have looked at. So there's one set of explanations that are really psychological. There are a number of psychologists that have studied individuals in the lab, and they've basically seen what happens when you turn up the temperature in the lab, and it turns out when it gets hot, people get more aggressive, and it seems to be due to some changes in our brains, in our neurophysiology when it gets very hot. But there's a second set of explanations that are probably most important in low-income countries, and those are economic explanations. So in poor societies in rural Africa, Asia, and parts of Latin America, when it gets very hot and very dry and there's extreme climate, that's very important for those societies because they're overwhelmingly agricultural. So their crops aren't going to do well when there's very extreme climate. And when their crops fail, they enter very difficult economic times.
Hmm. So talk about your research a little bit. How far back did you go in researching this, and what groups of people were you looking at?
We tried to be as comprehensive as we could. We actually, for the first time, put together studies from many different disciplines, from economics to history, archaeology, psychology, political science. So we tried to be as comprehensive as we could across time and also across space. So we have studies on crime in the U.S. and also on violence around the world. And from archaeology and history, we were able to go back in time, sometimes a couple thousand years. I think most of your listeners know about the use of tree rings or sediment deposits to capture the way the climate was even, you know, centuries ago. So we have some studies that go far back. For instance, there's a study on the Mayan civilization in Mexico, which finds that the collapse of the Mayan civilization into really violent civil war occurred after a century of very hot and dry climate. And so, you know, even for things as important as the collapse of entire civilizations, very extreme climate can be a very important factor.
Let's dig into that a little bit. I'm curious how you can tell by looking at tree rings and sediment deposits what the climate was like at a time.
Yeah, so, you know, what ends up happening is, say, for in a given year, if it's if temperatures are moderate and there's enough rainfall, trees grow more than they would, say, during times of worse weather. So that's how tree rings are used to get a sense of what weather was like. In terms of sediment deposits, it turns out that rainfall patterns and temperature sometimes drive the amount of things like titanium deposits or other metallic deposits in the ocean floor, in lake beds. And so what archaeologists do is they dig into these lake beds and they take out samples, and as they go back in time, you know, deeper and deeper into the sediment, they can get a sense of what climate was like even 1,000 years ago. It's pretty amazing.
Have you been able to determine whether the downfall of the Mayan civilization is just correlated with this this time in history where there was a century of hot weather, or do you know that there's a direct link between the two, a cause and effect sort of thing?
Yes. So I think, you know, just to be clear, we put together 60 studies across disciplines, and we subjected them to some statistical tests called meta-analysis, but these are studies by a lot of other scholars. What we did, and the condition for inclusion into our study, was that the data sets that we focused on had to be very rich. We basically only focused on data sets that had what's called longitudinal data. In other words, we had data on a lot of different locations at a lot of different time points. And the ability to use that kind of rich data actually helps us understand the causal effect of climatic changes on violence or other forms of conflict, because we're able to parse out or account for any fixed differences, say, between different locations or any fixed differences across time. So in some of the studies that we look at, there's a very strong relationship between high temperatures and crime, violent crime in U.S. cities in hot months. Those analyses don't rely on a comparison of, you know, Madison, Wisconsin versus Miami. Any kind of average difference between Madison and Miami is differenced out. So the statistics we're able to use with these rich data sets gives us a lot more confidence that what we're getting at is a true causal effect of temperature. Basically, what we're saying is in a very hot year in Miami, a very hot July, say, there's more crime compared to a cooler July in Miami. That's really what a lot of these relationships are based on, is that kind of longitudinal variation.
And you mentioned that there might be a biological explanation for this, so that when you look at people in a scientific environment and turn up the heat on them, that their behavior changes. Why does that happen?
You know, there's no consensus on the exact mechanism among the psychologists. There's been a lot of discussion about exactly what the neurophysiological changes might be. But what is very clear in a number of studies is that behavior does change and does become more aggressive at these higher temperatures. But one of the things we call for in this paper is more research precisely on the mechanism, so we can better understand exactly what those channels are. But the lab studies are actually really fascinating. There's a lab study on a police training course, and some psychologists actually varied the temperature that police faced in the different rooms as they were going through a training simulator, basically facing a computer screen. They had to decide when to simulate pulling a weapon or how to respond to a potential incident, and the police in the very hot room responded much more aggressively than the police in the cooler training simulation room. So there's some really interesting findings out there.
Yeah, that is interesting. That's another layer to this. So is there an actual estimation as to how much violence will increase with, you know, every rising degree in the temperature over time?
There is, and that's one of the contributions of our paper, is to try to combine all these dozens of different studies to try to come up with some overall numbers. We divided the studies into a couple different groups. We focused on the one hand on what we call interpersonal violence, so things like violent crime, and on the other hand, intergroup violence, things more like civil wars or riots, really society-wide phenomena. And we analyzed those different studies separately because they're somewhat different phenomena. When we look at the interpersonal violence, like crime, in the U.S., the best sort of estimates we have is that if we go out to about 2050, the climate science predicts the world is going to warm by about 2 degrees Celsius. So that's almost 4 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's a pretty large average warming. Our best estimate is violent crime will increase by somewhere between 5 to 10% over that time period. When we look at the intergroup violence, and a lot of those studies and a lot of the data sets we have there from low-income countries in Africa, Asia, Latin America, there are much bigger effects. So the prediction there is that intergroup violence might increase by 40 to 50% over the next half century or so. Conflicts in those settings are very, very sensitive to high temperature.
And just in our last minute here, is there any way to mitigate the violence levels? I mean, is even being aware of it one step toward, proactively trying to work against it?
We think so, and I think that's really the million-dollar question, is what to do next. When it comes to thinking about low-income societies for whom high temperatures and drought conditions really are a major economic calamity, there are some types of policies that could help. So developing new drought-resistant and high-temperature-resistant crops would be a very important way forward. But as you said, even understanding the relationship can be a starting point. If police chiefs are just much more aware of how crime spikes when the temperature is high, maybe they can devise some better policing strategies, putting more police on the streets when the weatherman says it's going to be very hot.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for telling us about your study.
Thanks a lot for having me.
That was Edward Miguel. He is a professor in environmental and resource economics at UC Berkeley.
And now we'll check the headlines, and then we'll talk about the launch of Al Jazeera America today, a network that hopes to make a splash in the cable news biz. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks, Kristen. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Al Jazeera is launching its American network today and is hoping to be a game changer in American cable news.
Back in January, they purchased Current TV for $500 million and have since then been preparing for today's launch.
Al Jazeera already has Arabic and English-speaking news channels that have been successful around the world.
Here to talk with us about the new network is Brian Stelter. He covers television and digital media for the New York Times, and he's the author of Top of the Morning. Thank you for joining us, Brian.
Thank you.
So Al Jazeera America seems to be branding itself as a hard-hitting, serious news network. It's going to have less opinion, less advertising. Can we expect them to deliver on all this?
They seem to have just started to do that. They've been on the air for about an hour now. And one of the things that's noticeable is an emphasis on serious, hard news. Another thing that's noticeable is fewer commercials. And that speaks to one of two things. One thing is that the channel is funded by the Emir of Qatar, which has seemingly limitless funds for Al Jazeera, thanks to the oil and gas reserves in that country. And then number two, they are having some hard time, it seems, attracting advertisers. And so as a result, they're depending less on ads and more on the subsidy from the government.
Well, as long as you brought up ads, part of the Al Jazeera story that we're hearing is that, you know, maybe they don't need the ads that much. They are financed to the teeth, it
That's
sounds
right.
like.
Well, they are like in the BBC or Russia Today or Chinese state television. They're subsidized by a government, so they don't have the same financial pressures as commercial networks in this country like CNN or Fox News or MSNBC. They do say, though, that they are, their goal, like any other channel, is to make money, even though they do have wealthy backers. They're trying to get a subscriber fee from cable distributors, just like Fox or MSNBC, and they're trying to have advertisers as well. But it's hard to launch a new channel these days, very hard, and Al Jazeera's success or failure will be measured years from now, not anytime soon.
Now tell us a little bit about who's funding Al Jazeera and how that's different from other cable news networks.
You look at CNN or Fox News, these are channels that are owned and operated by big media companies like Time Warner in CNN's case, or the News Corporation in Fox News' case. They expect to make a profit and do, big profits every quarter. Al Jazeera is different because it's funded by Qatar. And because Qatar created Al Jazeera, the Arabic channel, almost 20 years ago, in order to have more influence in the Middle East and around the world. And it's done that. It's been very successful. It's one of the preeminent Arab broadcasters, probably the preeminent Arab broadcaster. And its English language channel, called Al Jazeera English, is also very well respected in other parts of the world. But Al Jazeera English never succeeded in getting on in the United States. Companies like Comcast and Time Warner Cable generally refused to carry Al Jazeera English. That's why Al Jazeera went out and bought Al Gore's current TV for an estimated $500 million. That way, it basically bought the right to have a channel in the United States that companies like Comcast would carry. So now, as of today, you can watch Al Jazeera America, this brand new channel, in about half of the homes that have cable or satellite. Not quite half, but almost half. The rest of us will have to wait until the cable company we have either decides to carry it or until there's more availability of it on the Internet.
And is that likely to happen anytime soon as far as streaming goes?
Not in the short term. Maybe in the long term, though. There's been a lot of complaints online today because Al Jazeera took down the live stream that they used to provide to American viewers. It's the kind of thing that didn't have a big audience, but the people that liked it really, really liked it. You know, it, kind of like PBS. You know, their newscast is not that popular, but it's really, really loved by people who watch it. And that's what Al Jazeera wants to be, they say, in the United States. They want to kind of be a 24-hour version of the news hour on PBS. They want to be a sober, sophisticated, serious newscast around the clock. And if they succeed, well, that'll be a big addition to the media landscape here in the United States.
Now, what you're describing and what Al Jazeera America says it's going to be, it reads like a journalism professor's best dream ever.
It really does.
This is going to be a cable network that doesn't have to worry about money. It doesn't have to worry about advertising. If it's a good story, they can tell it. They don't have to worry how much it costs. And they're going to be serious about it. There's not going to be a lot of ads. I mean, if they succeed, what does that mean about media in America? Because we hear a lot of gloom and doom these days.
And, you know, and on the other hand, you do hear people, you'll hear people on message boards or people at diners when I ask them about media, you know, they'll say to me, I want a more reliable, less opinionated, less entertaining version of the news. I just want to know the facts. That's what Al Jazeera hopes is true. We'll find out if there really is an audience that actually wants to watch that. You know, after all, the BBC is sort of available in the United States, but not really. PBS is available, but it has a reputation for being older, you know, skewing older, maybe less appealing to young people. So Al Jazeera is coming along, presenting this almost as an experiment, you know, an experiment source to find out, will people tune in for a straightforward, no-nonsense take on what happened today in the U.S. and in the world? And maybe a couple of years from now, if we look at the ratings, we'll know if people are interested in that or not.
Are they likely to make it a couple years in if the ratings are down?
I think they will. I think they'll be here for the long term. Whether the ratings are there immediately or not, they have made such a big investment here, many hundreds of millions of dollars, and they're going to continue to do that in the years to come for a couple of reasons. One, Al Jazeera is pretty much available elsewhere in the world, so it believes it's important to be here in the United States as well. And to go back to the point about it being a dream come true for journalism professors, it really is almost like an employment act for journalists right now. I haven't seen this kind of investment in television news since Fox News and MSNBC launched, and that was back in the 90s. They've hired 900 people for this network, 400 of whom are editorial employees, which means anchors and producers and reporters. You know, that's a kind of investment that a lot of other journalists look at and really cheer. Whether they support Al Jazeera or not, whether they compete with it or want to watch it, it's a positive moment for journalism because of that investment that's happening. Of course, there are concerns about how the content will be presented. There's questions about bias. There's questions about point of view. And those are questions, of course, that follow every channel and every news report. They're unique in this case because of Al Jazeera's funding, because of its roots in the Middle East.
Now, Al Jazeera may not be terribly concerned about how many people are watching because they don't have to worry about money so much as we've been talking about. But if they don't have viewership, they're not going to have influence. That's one thing. And then I guess the other strand of that is that, you know, is Al Jazeera just out of the gate going to be stigmatized because America's first introduction has been the Osama bin Laden tapes back around September 11th?
That is going to be one of the steepest challenges they face. There is still a reputation that Al Jazeera faces in some pockets of the United States. In fact, I've noticed in a lot of the media coverage about Al Jazeera America launching that it's still the issues are still brought up. For example, you'll still hear people say, "Is it the terrorist network?" Or people will say, "Is it anti-American?" Those kinds of labels are usually unfair about anything. Things are always more complicated than they appear. But it's true that 10 years ago, this was the channel that was broadcasting audio tapes by Osama bin Laden. This was the channel that was showing civilian deaths in Iraq in a way that United States networks weren't. And it was a channel that was demonized by the Bush administration for being anti-American. I think some viewers will look past that and decide for themselves, while others will be much more skeptical. Of course, Al Jazeera points out that there's been a lot of foreign brands that have come into the U.S., faced skepticism, and succeeded. They point to Honda. They point to Toyota. They point to all those sorts of brands that were once viewed critically but are now embraced. We'll see if Al Jazeera can be one of those.
Now, we've just got about 40 seconds or so left, but what has been the response from the other prevailing princes of the cable news arena? It seems like it's kind of a shrug so far.
Shrug is exactly the word that one of the heads of one of the networks used when talking to me about this. None of them will go on the record and criticize Al Jazeera or welcome Al Jazeera. I've been struck by the lack of on the record comments about this new competitor. But I think everybody at the other broadcast networks, cable news networks, is looking at this a little with a lot of curiosity, a little bit of skepticism, and frankly, a bit of a dismissive tone. I'm not sure they think there's room for another network like this, but Al Jazeera is going to try to make room.
All right. Well, we'll be watching, and I'm sure you will be too. Brian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Brian Stelter, TV and digital media reporter for The New York Times. And what about you? Would you watch Al Jazeera? Will you watch it if it's available on your cable providers? Tell us what you think on the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk to one of the photographers featured in the Milwaukee Art Museum's exhibition called Wisconsin 30.
And then we'll hear how a mandate enacted a year ago called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival has affected young immigrants.
And then we'll be talking with a nutritionist about that slump that tends to hit around 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Your energy flags and you get ready to go home or take a nap, talking about how to beat that.
That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time.